Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankum, and one thing you may not know about me is my middle name is Harold, named after my great-grandfather, Harold Frankum. But I digress. I first want to just welcome any new listeners to the Leading LDS Podcast. We've definitely had an increase of listenership, and so the many people that are tuning in for maybe the first or second or third time, I welcome you. I hope you find good information here that will help you and inspire you to be a better leader. Now, in this episode, I had the opportunity to be invited downtown to the church history library and meet with Matthew Groh, who is the director of publications for the church history library. Really smart guy, really smart guy. We talked about how this interview came to be, but really solid information about councils and leadership and running a council and how Joseph Smith did it. Just some leadership principles and perspectives about Joseph Smith and some of the early leaders of the church that you probably have never had before. So definitely an interview to listen to. So here's my interview with Matthew Groh. Today, I find myself in downtown Salt Lake City in a pretty cool new building at the Church History Museum. Is that the right title? Is that what this building is?
This is the Church History Library.
Church History Library. Thank you. Church History Library. The museum is on Temple Square.
That's right. Okay. It's right to the west of Temple Square, just north of the Genealogy Library.
Cool. And I'm here with who you hear is Matt Groh. And you are the director of publications. Is that your official title?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what does that mean, the director of publications?
It means that I supervise the historical publications that the church produces. So these include the history section of LDS.org. They include the Joe Smith Papers and a bunch of other products that are designed both for scholars at times, like the Joe Smith Papers, but also products that are designed for the general membership of the church to increase their historical understanding, to increase their faith.
Hmm. That's quite the task, but nonetheless, it sounds like a fun job.
Yeah, so. I love it.
So what's your educational background to get you to a position like this?
Well, I've always loved history. I did my undergraduate in history at BYU, and then I went to the University of Notre Dame to do a master's and then a PhD in American history.
And so what's it like being a Mormon at Notre Dame, a Catholic university? Is there anything weird about it? Or
no, it was really great. Notre Dame is one of the great educational institutions, yeah. And they're particularly strong in terms of understanding religion, not just Catholicism, but all types of religion. So it was just a great atmosphere in which to go. And I focused on religious history. And so it was an ideal place.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just thinking of a Catholic going to BYU, would obviously be required to take Book of Mormon classes, religion classes. Is that any type of requirement there going to Notre Dame?
There is, and especially for graduate students. Oh, okay. There's not sort of a classes designed to help you understand Catholicism or anything like
okay.
that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's, I guess, nice. But you got enough to fill your brain. You
that's
might
right.
as well.
That's right.
So, and I would imagine they have a strong institute there, an LDS institute. And
you know, they actually, at least when I was there, there was no official institute program.
Oh,
there,
okay.
there was a stake institute. And part of the reason is that there are very, very few undergraduates who are LDS at Notre Dame.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So there tend to be, at least when I was there, you know, 10 years ago, there would be 15 or maybe even 20 graduate students, but very few undergraduates to whom you would target an institute.
Gotcha.
So there would be a stake institute to help those few students as well as students in the surrounding area.
Yeah. Did you go to any football games?
Oh, I did get a chance to go to all of the Notre Dame BYU football games.
Nice.
And I was there, three of them, one here in Provo, two at Notre Dame.
And you wore blue, I hope.
we did have signs that said Mormons for Notre Dame.
Okay,
so,
good.
You have to go with where you're at.
Okay, you know, allegiance is fine. I always joke, I went to, I was turned down three times from BYU, and so I went to the University of Utah,
okay.
though I had season tickets to BYU football. So I often tell people, you know, when they hear that I didn't come out as a huge Ute fan, I tell them, well, if I went to Notre Dame, I wouldn't become Catholic, you know, so anyways, but nonetheless, as far as sports go, I think
that's
it's
right.
good.
I did convert in terms of football.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. That's good. We won't tell anybody around here, but another little factoid about us is your parents were my mission president, and wife and whatever the title is, but they were, I think I had them almost exactly a year, and then the other president, President Hansen, a year after them. And I remember it was, you know, it doesn't surprise me that President Groh's son is the director of publications for the church, because his zone conferences were like, you just sort of buckled up and he would tell us these, you know, this doctrine or historical facts, and you were just like taking notes, and everybody sort of left. And I remember during studies, just, you know, some elders acting as if they were in one study going to gain the knowledge of President Groh, you know, because he was, it was so fun to listen to, and had such an incredible mind. And so anyways, wonderful, wonderful people, as you would probably agree.
Yeah, definitely. And my parents do love the doctrine of the church, and they love to teach it.
So did they start you on this path of history?
You know, the family I grew up in was a historically conscious family. Mm-hmm. And so my parents were very interested in teaching us about both our pioneer ancestors, but also about other elements of history. And we went on church history tours and these sort of things. And so definitely that helped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I always loved the President Groh would always encourage us to bring doctrinal questions to our interviews with the president.
Okay.
You know, and I remember bringing in various questions and really, I mean, giving me a new perspective to see things, and or he would invite us to write in our letter to the president questions. And I remember several times the phone ringing during study, and it was him, you know, calling to answer this question that he'd asked. But a great leader. And I remember that, if I remember right, he and you are a descendant of Parley P. Pratt.
Right.
And is that leading to you helped co-author the biography of Parley P. Pratt?
Yeah, no, that was definitely a big part of my interest in understanding Parley. Both as a descendant and as a historian, right? Trying to place him in his historical context. But certainly, I got started down that path.
Yeah. And I've attempted a few times to read the autobiography of Parley P. Pratt. And it's definitely, it's not an easy read, in my opinion, as someone who's not an intellectual.
Right.
What were you trying to accomplish with this biography of Parley P. Pratt?
Yeah.
I guess it wasn't all contained in his autobiography.
Right. So Parley's autobiography, he actually starts before he dies, obviously. And the first part of the autobiography, he's writing it from scratch. It's a great narrative. That's the part where he says he encounters the Book of Mormon and he can't eat or sleep. And it's a really engaging narrative. But as his autobiography goes on, he then begins to pull things from other sources. So stuff he's already written, he puts in big portions of his journal, and it becomes more difficult to read. So what we wanted to do with the biography was to put him in his historical context and to cover really two areas that he doesn't talk about much in his autobiography. The first is his publications. He was really the voice of early Mormonism. He was he was the main writer for books outside of the scriptures. And he doesn't explore that himself in his autobiography, and we wanted to do that. The other thing is he doesn't talk much about his family, hardly at all. Mm. And that is really how people wrote autobiographies in the 1800s. They just didn't talk much about their families. And he had a very rich family life and a lot of other records that we were able to talk about what his family meant to him, and put that in the context of his life. Wow.
That's great. And so, and I mean, he's sort of known as sort of the missionary. I mean, he was constantly on missions, right?
Right.
And he died on a mission.
That's right.
And I think your dad was involved in trying to figure out where he was buried.
That's right.
And did they ever find where he was buried or his body? Or,
you know, so he dies in 1857 in Arkansas, and we know the cemetery that he was buried in. It's just it's a small family cemetery. And before he died, Parley had expressed a dying wish that his remains be taken to Utah and buried with his people, with his family. And so over the years, there was traditions or clues as to where he might actually lay in that family cemetery. And, it's probably been 10 or 15 years or so ago, the latest scientific research, ground penetrating radar and other things were combined with historical clues to try to zero in on where that gravesite might be. And the people involved with that project believe that they found the gravesite. But the remains were totally decomposed. It's very acidic, very wet soil. And the local county coroner said, we've tried to exhume people buried much more recently than Parley Pratt, and there's just nothing.
Wow.
Nothing.
Yeah, I would imagine embalming techniques weren't up to par as they are today, nor would I even expect him being embalmed, right? I mean, I'm sure.
And it's not a metal coffin and so on.
So couple decades, and there's probably not much to recover there. So interesting, but nonetheless, a great trying to honor that request that he had of looking, and it's a fun scavenger hunt to a historian, right?
So that's right.
So what, as you look back, just generally speaking, what did you learn, or what traits do you admire about Pardley P. Pratt and what he did for the church that maybe, you know, the lay leaders of the church could gain from understanding?
Well, I think one thing that Pardley did was he was bold in his beliefs. Mm. So he never shied away from telling people exactly what he believed. He didn't try to smooth off the edges of the beliefs. Mm-hmm. He said, this is what Mormonism is. This is what the church is. I'm going to be bold in talking about it. I think another of the real qualities of Pardley Pratt was that he was just tireless. Mm. I mean, he was a tireless missionary, constantly going out on missions. And I think one thing that I saw as his biographer was the toll that took on his family, right? And so him trying to achieve this balance between what he felt was his apostolic duty and his duties to his family. And I'm not sure he always struck the right balance there. Right. I think that's something that local leaders always have to struggle with, right? Yeah. The demands of the call versus the demands of work life versus the demands of family life, trying to figure out that balance.
Yeah. So was there much effort that you saw that of him trying to create that balance, or?
Sure. I think when he was home, he was home. Hmm. And his children talk about what a loving father he was. And of course he lived in the age of polygamy. So he has many wives, and he seems to have very good relationships with his wives and his children.
Yeah.
And so I think when he was home, he was there. Hmm. But he was often gone as well.
Yeah. And he was gone years at a time. I mean,
sometimes years at a time.
Wow.
Yeah.
And he was an apostle. Again, I'm not a historian, but I mean, he was an apostle for most of his life.
Yeah. So he's called in 1835 with the original quorum.
Okay. He's an original apostle.
That's right. And then he serves until his death in 1857.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, and he died after Joseph Smith, and
right.
Yeah.
That's
wow.
right. Yeah.
Wow. That's definitely one that I need to spend more time with.
Yeah.
But an inspiring individual in the history of the church, and I love just that grit he had about going out there and being a missionary. And
right.
And I'm glad you touched on this balance of home and you know the work in the Lord, the work of the Lord, because this is something that on a much smaller scale that you know bishops or stake presidents, Relief Society presidents are constantly struggling with, you know, how do I be home and how do I serve with all my mind and strength? And
absolutely.
And it's something that I think it's good to just note that this was a struggle from the restoration of the gospel early
absolutely.
On, you know, and I mean, Joseph Smith's life is definitely one to examine in that perspective as well. So I first came, I first heard you speak professionally as a historian at the Fair Mormon Conference this past July, I want to say, in 2016. And I saw your name on the program, and that you were talking about the minutes of the Council of 50. And I thought to myself, what on earth is the Council of 50? You know, we've heard the Council of the 70, the Quorum of the 12, but never the Council of 50. And so just give us a brief general explanation of what the Council of 50 is and why we, you know, other people, other than people that don't geek out over LDS history should need to know and understand this.
Yeah. So the Council of 50 was an organization set up by the Prophet Joseph Smith in March 1844. So that's 3 months before his death. And it's intended to form the pattern of what the government might be like during the millennium. Mm-hmm. And it was also intended to protect the church temporally and politically. Hmm. So the council does a couple of things. One is that it's looking for possible new settlement sites should the Mormons have to leave Nauvoo. Hmm. So they're looking at all sorts of sites, Oregon and California and Texas and the Rocky Mountains, as possibilities for where the saints might have to go. At the same time, Joseph Smith is pursuing a presidential campaign. He's running for the U.S. president. Again, as a way to protect the Mormons' rights. Mm-hmm. So, of course, what happens to the Mormons in Missouri, the expulsion from the state, really sets the context for this. Joseph Smith and other Mormons believed that their rights hadn't been protected.
Yeah.
And so they wanted to form a group that could help protect those rights.
And it, as far as help protect those rights, just talking about maybe political strategies they could do to get some legislation put in place or get, you know, congressmen on their side or that type of thing?
That's right. So they're pursuing all sorts of strategies. Some of it's political. Let's send a representative to Washington. Let's send petitions to Washington. Some of it's strategic. Maybe we should move out of the United States to form a government, a theocracy, they called it, or a theodemocracy, by which they meant a government of God instituted through the people. And so they're pursuing a number of paths with this ultimate aim of protecting the church and providing it space to flourish.
Yeah. So what was, what would you say is the complete end game of something like this? Was it just to have a group that's talking about certain concerns in relation, you know, political concerns related to the church as a body? Or, you know, maybe some critics will say, well, you know, this group wanted to, you know, elect Joseph Smith president and then take over the U.S. government or something. Right. I mean, what was the end game in, in general?
The end game, if you read what they say in their meetings, the end game is to, is really to find a place where the Mormons can be protected in their rights, where their religious liberty can be preserved. Yeah. And so from the outside, the council can look kind of scary. It's a secret government. It's Joseph Smith trying to rule the world. It's this sort of thing. But really, if you read what they're talking about in their meetings, they're saying, how can we be protected in our rights? And how can we protect others in our rights? So when Joseph runs for president, he doesn't say, I'm campaigning for the rights of Mormons. He says, I'm campaigning for the rights of all. Yeah. And he's particularly concerned about the rights of minority groups against what they called the tyranny of the majority. America in 1844 didn't have as many protections as America does now.
Yeah.
And so part of what Joseph is saying is that we need stronger protections for minority groups.
Wow. I could see why that would be definitely important and something to organize. But Joseph Smith didn't intend this to be an official auxiliary of the church. Is that right?
He says it's a, he says it's separate from the ecclesiastical organization of the church. He says it's the beginning of the kingdom of God in a political sense on the earth. So they don't do ecclesiastical things in the council. They don't ordain officers. They don't teach doctrine.
Yeah.
But they're more concerned about these political strategies.
Yeah. So you know, comparing that with a the Council of 70, the Quorum of the 70, where, you know, this is something that where authorities delegated, where they're set apart, where this is mainly more like they would invite people into this Council of 50. And I think you even mentioned there's a few non-members that were part of this council.
That's right. So Joseph wants to have a few non-Mormons on the council to make the point that in the kingdom of God, religious liberty is protected. Hmm. You don't have to be a Latter-day Saint to have your liberty.
Nice. So so maybe just finishing off this general timeline. Obviously, I mean, the book you've put together about this is thick, and there's a lot to go into.
Right.
But after Joseph Smith is martyred, obviously that sort of ends, and that's during his political campaign as president, right?
So that's right.
What was the role of the Council of 50 now that the Quorum of the Twelve and Brigham Young are running things?
So after Joseph dies, the council doesn't meet for about 6 months. And then Brigham Young calls them back into action because the Nauvoo Charter, which is what gives them the license to have a city government, is taken away by the state legislature.
Oh, well.
On the belief that Mormons can't govern themselves.
Okay.
And this really makes the Mormons vulnerable because it means they don't have a police force, they don't have a local militia, they don't have a local court system. And so it really just creates all this concern among Brigham Young and others about, again, how we're going to protect our rights. So they call the council back into action, and the council plays a very important role in determining where the saints are going to move and in choosing the Valley of the Great Salt Lake as that final location. Once they get to Utah, the council continues to meet for a couple of years until there's a formal territorial government. And then the council doesn't meet again really until the 1880s, which is a time of a lot of pressure from the federal government, the era of the raids against polygamy. And it meets for a few years under John Taylor, and then the council stops meeting. And of course, the council doesn't exist today.
Yeah. And would you say it fizzled out, or was it more of like Brigham Young saw, you know, there's just really no need for this.
Yeah.
I'm disbanding. Is it?
That's right. I mean, Brigham sees that there's other governmental structures in place, so you don't need the Council of 50.
That's interesting. And now they sort of got to a place where they felt like, you know, there's some stability as far as government's concerned. I think Brigham Young was the governor of the state quite a few years, and you know, just those roles maybe were in place in lieu of this Council of 50. So
yeah.
So going back a little bit, well, let's just talk about, before I get into that, is that what the church, this research you've done is officially part of the Joseph Smith Papers, right?
That's right.
And for many years, there was this knowledge of the Council of 50, but the church wasn't releasing the minutes, or people didn't really know what they were talking about or what they were doing.
Right? That's right. So the minutes of the Council of 50 have never been previously available to scholars or in terms of a publication or anything like that. A few years ago, the First Presidency decided that the time was right to publish these records as part of the Joseph Smith Papers. The Joseph Smith Papers is a huge project. It'll be 26, 27 books. We're about halfway there. And it's intended to publish all of the records associated with Joseph Smith, and the Council of 50 Minutes fit into that category. And so it was determined that we should go forward and publish those records. But because the records weren't available, the council engendered a lot of speculation, right? Why are these records being kept hidden? What is in these records? There must be awful things in these records. and really there's terrific things in the records. And I think one of the things that local leaders would be most interested in is how Joseph Smith ran a council.
Yeah.
Joseph was very interested in the topic of councils. He believed that councils were how the church was governed in ancient days. And that he said that the form of a government by councils was given to him by vision. And one of the questions that people sometimes have about church history is, why is there so many revelations in the very early years of the church? So if you look at your Doctrine and Covenants, when do the revelations come? 1829, 1830, 1831. And then they drop off in the mid-1830s. Why is that? One of the reasons is because by the mid-1830s, there's councils in place. They're the high councils. There's bishoprics. And Joseph is pretty clear that the councils are where revelation should come. So we don't need a single revelator, Joseph Smith, answering every question.
Or even an ancient prophet that's appearing, right?
That's
dictating what that is.
That's right. Instead, we're supposed to counsel together with inspiration from heaven and then come to the correct decisions and again be confirmed in those decisions by inspiration. So one of the things that Joseph Smith said is that one of the duties of every member of the councils is to speak candidly. He was self-aware enough to know that people didn't always speak frankly in his presence. He knew that he had a position.
I would be intimidated. Whatever you want, Brother Joseph, you know.
Right. He knew he was church president. Sometimes people told him what he wanted to hear.
Yeah.
So on the first day of the council, he said, "I want you to say what's in your hearts, whether good or bad." Then he said, "I don't want to be surrounded by a set of dough heads." And by this, he means a set of yes men. It says, "I don't have a use for that type of counsel. I want you to speak your mind." A couple months later, he says that the reason why men always failed to establish important measures was because in their organization, they never could agree to disagree long enough to select the pure gold from the dross by the process of investigation. So he says, in this council, we have to agree to disagree long enough to really think through, debate, deliberate, and issue. And then we'll be able to select the pure gold from the dross.
Wow, right? I love that. That's great.
That is when the revelation comes, when the council process is working. So the way he established a council is that he would sit at sort of the head of a circle. To his right was the oldest man on the council, and so on around the circle until at his left sat the youngest man on the circle. Now, we don't organize councils according to the age of the participants
anymore.
Yeah,
that may offend some people in more counseling.
That could be awkward.
Yeah.
Now, brother over here, you know, sister over there. So, but there was a sense that he wanted years of experience to be honored. He felt that people who had lived longer, who had served longer, had certain wisdom, and that they should speak at the beginning of the council, and then it would go on around the council. He often wouldn't interject until the very end of the discussion. which again, I think he knew that if his opinion was on the table, it would become the group's opinion. So yeah, he was very careful about that.
Yeah. And there's so much to, I love this idea of disagreeing, however you said, disagreeing long enough.
Yeah.
And I think that's such a good way to kick off a ward council meeting or a high council meeting, whatever it is, and just say, you know, our intention here is that we can disagree long enough to get to the gold, you know, the true inspiration where, and even Liz Wiseman in her leadership research, she talks about this idea of being, you know, a multiplier as a debate maker, somebody who can go into a meeting and create debate among those that are involved, because that's where the best ideas, the best inspiration come from. And so,
right.
And this is, I mean, it's easier said than done to be like, well, I want everybody to argue in here. So go, you know, because some people just, they avoid conflict and it's hard, but to, What a leadership skill to sort of encourage that and try and drum that up in the meeting of debate and disagreeing so that we can get to the pureness of inspiration.
Yeah. Another thing that really struck me about the minutes was how seriously they took their councils. And so oftentimes there would be assignments given in a council, a committee established. Committee was supposed to report back. Mm-hmm. And they would start their meetings by reading the minutes of the previous meeting. So they took very full minutes, and then they would take 10, 20, 30 minutes and read what they had discussed in the previous meeting. And part of that, I think, was to understand exactly what the assignments were, and then they would call on people to report back on their assignments. So one example I love is that on the first day of the council, four men were given the assignment to write a constitution for the kingdom of God.
Oh, wow. There's kind of a task.
It's a daunting assignment, right? But he chose four of the brightest writers and thinkers in the church, Parley Pratt, John Taylor, W.W. Phelps. So it was a really strong committee.
Yeah.
But they were totally overwhelmed by the task. And every week for the first 6 weeks or so, they would say, well, how's that coming on that committee? They would say, well, this is really hard, you know.
Yeah.
They would have some excuses. And finally, they said, Joseph, why don't you just join the committee and tell us what we need to do?
And make it easier for us.
Joseph said, no way.
Yeah.
You've got to go through the process. You've got to think this out. And he said, we have to, each one of us has to seek that wisdom from heaven. And we have to go through this process. I think that's really shown by how they decide where the saints should go. And so Joseph, on the first day of the council, they talk about three places. They say, well, maybe we should go to Texas. Maybe we should go to Oregon. Maybe we should go to California. You'll notice that Great Salt Lake isn't on that council. Although at the time, it's really part of California, Mexican California.
Yeah.
The Lord didn't tell Joseph in 1844 where they should go. The Lord expected them to go through this whole process of investigating the matter, reading the latest reports, meeting with mountain men and explorers, sending out explorations of their own. And only at the end of that, and as they go along, they cross off options. They say, well, Texas isn't going to work out. Oregon's not going to work out for these reasons. And then gradually they begin to zero in on what we know as Utah, the Salt Lake Valley. And it's only at the end of the process that Brigham Young says the revelation came.
He confirmed it. Yeah.
The revelation is confirmed to him by the Spirit. And he says, now I know the spot. But they have to go through this whole process of deliberating and debating and investigating. And the Lord didn't cut that process short for them. It took them almost 2 years.
Yeah. Wow. That's encouraging for, you know, I just think of, you know, a stake that's doing the boundary, realigning the boundaries, you know, where should this neighborhood go on that? But to go through that process and once you're there, the Lord will confirm it and you can move forward, you know? And I think even sometimes in these council decisions, we come to a decision that doesn't necessarily, it's not like, you know, we all have a burning in our bosom and we know where to move forward, but we just feel like, well, this is the best we can do with the knowledge we have, the experience we have. Let's move forward and see what doors the Lord opens, you know?
Yeah.
But wow, what a fascinating perspective on councils. And I love this idea of that Joseph Smith saw the purpose of councils and that the Lord revealed sort of the structure of the church and the ordinances, the very specifics of information, then left it up to councils to carry it forward. And that there's no reason, you know, you're not a a horrible bishop if there are not angels appearing to you at night, or you know, that something remarkable is happening in these council meetings. But it's through that council that the inspiration will come, and that's encouraging for sure.
Right. I think another of the principles of counselors is that Joseph expected all to participate. So the rule of the Council of 50 was that all could speak on every issue. Now, of course, not everyone did.
Yeah.
Some seemed not to have spoken very much at all, but all had the right to speak on every issue. So you can imagine a ward council with 50 people on it, you know, yeah. so these meetings went on a long time sometimes, but the principle of everyone having that right to participate on the council. And then, like you said, sometimes we have to figure out how to draw that participation out of people on the council who may be more reluctant, because they're not as experienced, because, they're one of two women on the council with, you know, six or seven or eight men, or, you know, there's lots of reasons people might not speak in a council, and we have to figure out how to draw that out.
Yeah. But nonetheless, making it clear that that the leader wants to hear from individuals, and Joseph did that as well. And then, I don't know if you mentioned this, but Joseph would, you know, they would sit in a circle and go around, and everybody would speak before Joseph spoke, right? Because he didn't want to influence.
In general, that's right.
Generally speaking. Yeah. Wow, that's. And so in between each of these council 50s, I mean, were these a weekly meeting, a quarterly meeting?
They tended to be about a weekly meeting.
Oh, wow. And they sometimes lasted all day.
They did.
I mean, they didn't have Netflix back
then.
This
was serious business.
Nothing to do other than sitting in meetings. So no. But obviously, you know, serious business, and a lot was going on that they needed to address. Well, that's great. And so in this, what would you call it, a compilation or of the minutes?
Right.
How does the book flow? Is it just chronologically all the minutes?
That's right. So it's the first thing to understand about the Joseph Smith Papers is that the audience is scholars. So the purpose of the Joseph Smith Papers is to make sure that anyone who writes on Joseph Smith, whether Mormon or non-Mormon, whether scholar or not, has to listen to his voice. His records are going to be so available that you can't write on him in a credible way without going through what he wrote. And so to make that credible for non-Mormons, there's a lot of footnotes, there's a lot of scholarly apparatus. And so that's one thing to know, is that going in, you won't hear us talk about the prophet Joseph Smith, right? We won't use devotional language because our audience are scholars, many of whom wouldn't be members of the church. So the way this book is set up is the meetings are laid out in chronological fashion, and there's an introduction that tells you a general overview of what happened. And then there's a lot of footnotes giving you more specifics.
That's great. That's great. And definitely for an academic audience, an intellectual audience.
Right.
This isn't light reading that you gather the kids around, right?
You know, we of course, we would love it if every member of the church read through the 27 volumes when we're done, but we're not foolish enough to think that's going to happen. One thing we do is we try to partner with others here in the church organization to make sure that people writing curriculum manuals have the latest findings and the latest research on Joseph Smith, so that you can get the benefits of the Joseph Smith Papers, those insights, in the regular course of your church work, rather than saying, I need to become an expert and read all these books.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I feel like shifting away from the Council of the 50 a little bit and just speaking more broadly, I feel like I would do my audience a disservice if we didn't address, you know, general historic issues of the church. And that's nothing we can do in the few minutes we have left, but, you know, specifically, but from your perspective, as someone who works in the church history library, what guidance or where would you point leaders that maybe are working with people that come to them with historic concerns about the church? Obviously, we have the church history essays, or what do you call those? The church.
The gospel topics essays.
Gospel topics essays, which are fantastic. But what would you say towards that, to helping a leader mentor somebody through some difficult historical concerns?
Yeah. First of all, Elder Ballard gave some terrific advice on this in an address to CES instructors earlier this year. And he laid out a few principles. And one of those principles is don't dismiss the question. Take the question seriously. Take the questioner seriously. You know, and of course, we know that the church started with a question. We believe in good questions. And Elder Ballard also said you can't testify the question away. So it doesn't work if someone comes with a serious question just to bear your testimony to them. That, he says, misses the mark. Rather, we have to take the question seriously. And that doesn't mean that you have to be an expert on church history, because We are a church of lay leaders. We don't have trained theologians and trained historians leading our congregations.
That's why we're talking into these mics, my friend.
But I think what the church has tried to do is to provide a set of resources in recent years for aimed at people who may be struggling mm-hmm. with questions related to church history, and also aimed at local ecclesiastical leaders. So if you go to the leadership portal, there are synopses of the gospel topics essays. Hmm. And so that would be a great place to start with those short synopses, about a page each, mm-hmm. that will tell you, here's the issue that people might be struggling with on the book of Abraham. And here's some ways to think about that issue. Of course, one of the things that Elder Ballard said to CES instructors was that they should know the gospel topics essays like the back of their hands. Hmm. And someone in a CES role is going to have much more opportunity in general, I think, to mentor or to respond to questions about history than a local bishop or Relief Society president. But nevertheless, I think that our local lay leaders first need to know that these essays exist. They need to know that these essays weren't just written by, you know, a bunch of historians, but that these essays were written by historians in conjunction with the leadership of the church. The essays were approved by the First Presidency, the Quorum of the Twelve. They're official essays of the church. They're found on LDS.org. And so local leaders should be aware of their existence, and I think they should be aware of the general content of these essays, because we are in an age of the internet. Yeah, we're in an age in which every social media account can be the purveyor of information that can be troubling. Mm-hmm. And generally the information is put in regarding church history on the internet is often put in the most troubling light. It's misconstrued. There's elements that are true, but then it's put in its worst possible light. So I think what the Gospel Topics essays try to do is to say, here is an issue that people may be concerned about. Here is the real historical facts. And here's how to think about it in a way that might build faith. So I think in my experience talking with people who've been troubled by church history issues, one of the big issues is that they feel like the church hasn't been forthcoming with them, hasn't been open with them. Mm-hmm. Why am I only learning about Joseph Smith Searstone now? And I'm 30 and I've served a mission and I feel like someone along the line should have told me and I've been betrayed.
Yeah.
Right. And I think the Gospel Topics essays really help us as a church with that. We're trying to be transparent. Mm-hmm. We're trying to say, here's the best historical evidence on these questions. Come and read it. Come engage with it. And one of the things that the church is trying to do is to also incorporate this information into seminary lessons and into institute lessons that people don't have that feeling of surprise in the future.
Yeah.
But I think if someone comes with that feeling of surprise, we do need to understand that the church has taken a lot of measures in recent years, but also some in the distant past, to make the history available, to make it transparent, to help people.
Yeah, that's great. And those are wonderful resources. And maybe you're not, you know, and maybe you're not allowed to say, are there more to come as far as the gospel topic essays, or have they sort of, they've definitely hit the big ones.
Right, right. So the original commission was to write on the essays that are currently out. And I'm sure the leadership of the church, if they want to commission a new essay, they'll certainly do so. But the thinking was that those were the major issues and to provide a resource. So I wouldn't be looking for new essays in the next months or anything like that.
Sure. Well, that's great.
Can I mention a couple other historical resources?
Oh, please.
For people to be aware of. One is the history section on LDS.org.
Okay.
And on the history section on LDS.org, you'll find a number of subcategories that provide faith-promoting content on the history, individual stories. So one of the sections I really love is called Pioneers in Every Land. And the Pioneers in Every Land section tries to tell stories of the church's expansion worldwide. So for example, earlier this year, we released some videos on the church in Ghana. In 1989, the church entered a period of what the Ghanaian saints called a freeze. The church was expelled from Ghana. All the American missionaries were expelled, and church members were not allowed to meet. Wow. What is it that, and the church has only been in Ghana for 10 years at that point, so we have a very young leadership pool. And so we produced a couple of videos really focused on the question, how did the church survive that?
Wow.
And one of the keys that the Ghanaian saints talk about is home and visiting teaching. When they weren't allowed to meet as a congregation, they said that that program really bolstered, really saved their testimonies. And so from where I'm sitting in, you know, in Sandy, Utah, and I'm an elders quorum president, sometimes I'm like, you know, I'm not seeing a whole lot of benefit of the home teaching program, right?
We get the visits done, but it's not really changing lives, right?
Right. But then to see a moment where the church was in real crisis and what the local leadership is able to do. So I'd recommend going to that Pioneers in Every Land section.
Yeah, I'll definitely link to it.
There's also a great story about the church in Brazil and the temple caravans from Manaus and how the local leaders organize those caravans, and people travel 3,000 miles down the Amazon, down long Brazilian roads to get to the temple when it's only in São Paulo. So, and then one final plug. This next year, we're going to be studying church history in Sunday school.
Oh, okay.
And the church history and the Doctrine and Covenants.
Right, yep.
And there's a series on the history section called Revelations in Context. What it does is it tells you the backstory of each of the sections of the Doctrine and Covenants. Hmm. And it does that through the story of an individual. So these aren't sort of bare, boring historical facts. They're the story of how that section came about, was prompted by the needs of an individual. Hmm. And they're really powerful. So if you want to understand the Doctrine and Covenants in greater depth, that would be the place to start. That actually be in distribution centers, a print compilation of it in December, but it's already on the Gospel Library app or the history section.
Cool. Well, what my final question is, as you've had opportunity to work so closely in the history of the church, you know, learning about these past leaders that have gone before us, what do you think is the biggest, as far as leadership goes, and if you need some time we can edit out a long pause there if you need, but what leadership principle of past leaders stands out the most that we sometimes overlook or don't give enough credit to as far as of leading this modern day church?
So one of the things that that has really struck me as I've studied church history. I've been here about 6 years working for the church. I didn't intend to work for the church as my career. I was teaching at a university and opportunity came, and it took me several months to wrap my mind around working for the church rather than working at a university. And finally, I just felt like it was the right thing to do. So we moved from Indiana back to Utah. And a lot of people fear church history these days. It's seen as the source of trouble, right? Some people have been troubled. The first thing I'd like to say is that as someone who has studied the history, I mean, this is what I do for all day, right? I read Joseph Smith's mail. I look at his journal, right? I try to scour the sources. Church history in its totality is way more faith affirming than it is faith troubling. Our history is a story of people trying to become saints and doing it with inspiration from heaven and doing it through through the guidance of local leaders and doing it through their own faith and perseverance. And one of the leadership principles that has struck me as I've studied the past leadership of the church is that I think oftentimes there's a perception that when you hit a certain level of church leadership, revelation comes much easier.
Man, isn't that true? I can't agree with it more, right?
Right, or that it comes in a different format, right? That where we've sort of had to struggle for revelation and reach for it, it either comes more easily or it comes through audible voices or visitations. And those things do happen in church history.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they're very much the exception than the rule.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, President Hinckley taught that it's through the still small voice, right, that he led the church. And so I think to understand that throughout our history, leaders have had to struggle and work for and counsel together to receive the inspiration to lead the church. So one of the most powerful manifestations we know about in the last 50 years, of course, would be President Kimball's and the joint revelation received to extend the priesthood to all worthy men.
Yeah.
And that comes after years and years of struggle and prayer and fasting by President Kimball and others.
Yeah.
Right. So we shouldn't expect that, you know, if we're a bishop, that our stake president is just receiving revelation really easily. Or if we're a bishop, we think the Area 70 does that, or the member of the Quorum of the 12.
Yeah.
Right. We have to understand that revelation is real. It's powerful. It's the way that God guides our church. But we also have to understand that often it comes, like Joseph said, in these council settings, and that it's working it out together, and it's through that struggle, through that discussion that it can happen.
That concludes my interview with Matthew Groh. What a fantastic opportunity this was to learn from him. So much information, and it kind of had flashbacks of talking with President Groh, my mission president, and all the great information that I learned from him and now learning from his son. You know, some key points of key leadership points to learn from in this interview, just that the purpose of councils from early on in the church and how they are now the system for revelation, right? They're a model that we'll hopefully if done right, will lead to fantastic revelation and inspiration that can carry your ward or group or quorum forward. And so never underestimate the power of a council and debate in that council and hearing opinions that aren't like yours and really counseling together to getting to the goal, to the rich revelation that can move your organization forward. I have linked all of the resources and books and things that he talked about on the show notes of this episode. So if you're looking to jump into some of this information or get some of the books that Matt has put together for a church history department, go to leadinglds.org and find the show notes for this episode. And there, all the links are there, and you can jump in and have additional resources to prepare yourself to answer some of these tough questions related to history, but also have some resources that you can give out to individuals who can maybe do some studying and discovery on their own. I think a great place to spend a personal scripture study, right? And some of these resources the church has put together and just becoming more and more familiar with them. As always, all we ask from this audience is $1 a month for the content that we put together at Leading LDS. And if you kind of look over the last few 10 to 20 episodes that we've put together at Leading LDS, and you think, you know, those were really good, or there were some in that bunch that I've really appreciated, would you consider giving $1 a month to what we're doing at Leading LDS? And you can do that just by going to leadinglds.org, and there's a donation contribution link there that you can click on and contribute $1 a month or more and to what we're trying to do at Leading LDS. We're definitely not there, and we're still kind of running this on a shoestring budget, but I need your help to accomplish the goals that we have for the future. So until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.